Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams, Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman, Sten.
Here.
Potter.
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Agenda item 105, accept staff report and recommendation and order of council for Dominic J. Corrado, Measure 37 claim.
Staff, Chris, could you please come forward?
Good afternoon. I'm Chris Durth, the city's Measure 37 program manager, and I'm here to present a claim brought by Dominic Corrado. On his property in Southwest Portland, you can see there in the Maplewood neighborhood. Here's an aerial photo of the property. I want to point out a couple of things. You can see the house fronting on Southwest 49th and two streams running over the property on the northern and southern edges. These streams, even though they're not shown in the graphic, do converge and then flow into Fano Creek to the west here. We'll be focusing on the northern stream because that is where the claim is centered, on the northern part of the property, not necessarily the southern part. To summarize for you, the claim was brought by Dominic Corrado for his property at 6917 Southwest 49th Avenue, submitted on October of 2006. His compensation demanded is $88,720, and his preferred resolution is compensation or waiver of environmental regulations. As with all the previous claims, we look at these six criteria, and I will walk through each one of these in turn. But before I do, I want to give you a little background on the environmental, a couple of environmental regulations that were placed on the property. This one in 1982, prior to the 1991 purchase by the Corrados of this property, there was a 25-foot setback from the creek center line, which you can see in the graphic there. So this preceded their ownership in 1991. And secondly, the council placed environmental protections in the way of an environmental protection zone on the property. You can see which is the gray area outside of the green line there. On the Corrado property in 1994. That was subsequent to their purchase. To summarize, the regulations challenged are these. Half of them have to do with environmental zone regulations and the other half land division regulations. Mr. Corrado is challenging the requirement essentially for a resource tract on his property. These are indeed land use regulations and qualify under Measure 37. And they were enforced when Mr. Corrado received an approval for his proposed land division in June of 2005. This is sufficient enforcement for Measure 37 purposes. I should point out that Mr. Corrado did not appeal this approval to LUBA at the time, as was his right. At that time, when he was seeking his land division, because there is E-zone on the property, Mr. Corrado had two options. One, to seek environmental standards, to seek approval through meeting very set and specific environmental standards. Or secondly, to pursue environmental review, which is a much more flexible process and would have allowed more flexibility in development and, in the end, as I'll show, a greater net developable property for Mr. Corrado. The staff recommended that he pursue the second option, environmental review. He chose to go through and meet environmental standards, which he did. And that was his right, his choice. He received approval by meeting environmental standards, and the approval allows him today to develop what you see there is Area A, the orange area, on his property. The subdivision line is the one stretching from right to left across about the top third of the property. If he had sought the option of environmental review, which he could have at the time and which was recommended, he could have received permission to develop, in addition to the orange shaded property there, the purple property on his on his subdivision as well. So he could have received permission under environmental review to develop a greater amount of property than under the environmental standards option. And what I would, why this is important is that the net developable property that he could receive under environmental review, and that's still an option for him now, is greater than would have been allowed when he purchased the property in 1991. If I'll point out to you in this graphic here, the pink areas are areas that would not have been able to be disturbed or developed in 1991 when he purchased the property, but they would be allowed under environmental review today. So he, in fact, could have had a net increase in developable property under today's environmental review standards had he chosen to go that way. So our conclusion from this is that because he has a greater area available for development if he chose to pursue environmental review, Mr. Corrado has not suffered a restriction in use of his property. He can still undertake that environmental review today if he so chooses. And because there's no restriction of use of the property, there's no reduction of fair market value either. In addition, I want to point out, even though we're basing our recommendation today on the no restriction in use aspects of this, I want to point out that this is similar to some of the claims that you've seen before, in that some of the environmental regulations that are challenged by Mr. Corrado are exempt under the public health and safety exemptions under Measure 37. I'll be very brief about this because you've seen this before. Measure 37, as you know, allows that those regulations that protect public health and safety are exempt. When you passed these environmental protections in 1994 that apply to Mr. Corrado's property, you stated in part that public health, safety, and welfare will be protected by environmental regulation, and you reiterated that in the emergency clause there. So these regulations that are challenged by Mr. Corrado are exempt under the public health and safety exemption because they prevent potential floods, landslides, and erosion. And this regulation protects water bodies and is also exempt. So in summary, we conclude that Mr. Corrado had, at the time he sought land division, and he still has, the option to undertake environmental review for his land division, which would have allowed him to develop the same amount or more land as when he purchased the property in 1991. And therefore, the use of his property has not been restricted, nor has the value been reduced. And in addition, I would point out that those three regulations we point out are exempt under the public health and safety exemption of the measure. Be happy to answer any questions. And therefore, our recommendation to you would be to deny Mr. Corrado's Measure 37 claim. And I should point out as a note here that Mr. Corrado has been very cooperative and easy to work with, and he has done what we recommend to all the claimants, which is talk to his neighbors. He's generated a dozen or more letters of support from his neighbors, and we thank him for that.
Questions? Thanks, Chris.
Okay.
The claimant, please come forward.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. You have a total of 15 minutes, sir.
Okay. Give me just a second to figure out how to get out of this.
Please state your name for the record.
Okay. All right. Okay. Mr. Mayor, Commissioners, my name is Dominic Corrado, 6917 Southwest 49th Avenue. And I am here today to convince you of the wisdom of allowing me to keep what is rightfully mine. Chris gave a summary of the claim, but he really only addressed one aspect of the many aspects of the claim, so I'd like to run through it again real quickly. It's true that I suffer a loss of 1,375 square feet of building area on Parcel 2, where I intend to build a new house, but just as important, the overall lot size of Parcel 2, because of the forced creation of an environmental tract through a forced change of ownership, results in an overall reduction of 33% in the size of that lot, which restricts use and reduces value. The reduction in size of the overall lot where my existing house would be drops 62% in size, which restricts use and reduces value. And this, incidentally, is independent of the building area on the other parcel. I'm also stripped of fee simple ownership because I now have 100% control over 100% of my property. If I'm forced to create an environmental tract, I'm forced to hold that in joint ownership with whoever happens to own my property, one or the other of the properties when I sell them. This is an arrangement that's really not satisfactory to me. It denies me the opportunity to restrict access to my property. It reduces my ability to use it, and it reduces the value of the property. Also, I'm required as a condition of approval of the land use to demolish a structure that's in use now, and it's not causing any problem. It just so happens that the barn is going to sit on a portion of this newly created forced environmental tract, and as such, I would have to demolish it even before I recorded the land use decision with the county. And if I had demolished it, obviously that reduces its value to zero and restricts me of its use. So I'm asking for relief of that as well. I appreciate Chris's comments on my dealings with them. I have found them to be courteous and attentive at all times, but I feel that I need to point out that there's an inherent conflict of interest in having the department that writes the regulations review claims against those regulations. They're doing their job, and I understand that, and they've been very good to work with, but I also have to point out that there was really never any serious attempt to reach a compromise. They pretty much stuck with the only option open to me being environmental review, which they claim is flexible. It's really only flexible for the other departments of the Bureau of Planning to be able to attach their own spending projects and saddle me with other terms and conditions of approval that can be very expensive. The overall process is much more complex and much more expensive. It still requires the creation of an environmental tract, which is the main thrust of my claim. And it also allows citizen groups to come in, like Southwest Trails or so forth, to demand a trail alignment through my property. I've been through environmental review before. I know how complex it is, and it's not just a flexible form of a Type 1 review. I contacted the neighbors after the city sent out the notification forms. I asked for an invitation to speak at the Neighborhood Association meeting. I did that in early January. They allowed me to make a presentation. There was no opposition at the time. I asked them if they were going to take a position. They said no. I asked them if they took it up at board level, would they give me a call and allow me an opportunity to participate? They said they would do that. I have not heard from them, so I'm assuming that they're not going to enter any opposition. The fact that they're not going to enter opposition, I think, has to go down in the win column for me on this one. I also contacted most of my neighbors, all of them that surrounded me, all the contiguous neighbors for sure. Staff has gotten 13 written letters of support that all acknowledge that what I'm asking to do is no threat to public safety. And you can see here, my property has the red dot. The shaded areas are all properties of people who have submitted testimony. So I think the ground truth here is that there's no opposition to this, and it does not jeopardize public health and safety. There are a number of exemptions. Chris alluded to a number of these already. I don't disagree with the fact that the 25-foot setback from the center of the creek line is not exempt, because that was in place when I bought the property. And I'm challenging Section 33.430.140.C2 because when you waive the restriction for the creation of the environmental tract, we'll have to find a different set of standards that determine where the disturbance area can be. So I'm not asking to be exempt from that. I'm looking for a substitution to that. There's numerous references to protection of public health and safety in staff's report. And what I'd like to point out, though, is that staff has not linked the public health and safety issues that would be raised by my development. They've not linked those concerns with how they would be remediated by forcing a change of ownership on my property. In other words, how does forcing the change of ownership on my property remediate any public health and safety concerns that are raised by the development? I'd like to have you ask them that question specifically if you're going to have them come back up and offer more testimony. there's hundreds of regulations in the Fan Oak Creek plan, and they regulate everything from the placement of exterior lighting to what plants you can place to the placement of buildings to sewer lines to road development. Which regs really protect public health and safety? Well, a theme crops up throughout their report, and I'd like to point to page one of the Fan Oak Creek and Tributaries Conservation Plan because I think it describes it very succinctly, and it doesn't surprise me entirely that they didn't quote this one, because what it says in the general findings, item three, page one, protection and conservation of these resources can also protect public health and safety by directing development away from portions of the city most prone to flooding and earth movement. So how's that again? By directing development away from the portions of the city most prone to earth movement and flooding. So where are these portions prone to earth movement and flooding? Let's take a look at the Portland hazard maps. You can see here that I'm nowhere near a 100-year floodplain, that I'm not in an area that is a potential landslide hazard or rapidly moving landslide hazard. I'm not in an earthquake hazard zone. I'm in a low to moderate zone, which is puts me actually in the minority in Southwest Portland, because most of Southwest Portland is at a much greater earthquake risk. So am I proposing development in an area that is prone to flooding or earth movement? No. There's no site-specific danger that warrants the forced creation of an environmental tract to prevent against this danger. Should I be exempt from the environmental regulations? Well, of course not. But should I be a target for a taking? Certainly not. Also, they suggest in their report that functional values can be preserved in the watershed. Water quality is an issue, but the fact of the matter is that only X number of people can live in the Fan Oak Creek watershed without affecting the water quality, and many hundreds times X already live here. The DEQ publishes its water quality index. Here's the last 15 years. This is the most recent report available. Fan Oak Creek was rated poor at the beginning of this period. There's no discernible trend. It's still rated as poor. So the measures that they're taking up to now have proven ineffective. And what they've done, instead of managing upstream degradation of Fan Oak Creek, upstream of me, they've decided to just punish the Creekside property owners more severely by forcing things like changes of ownership, which have absolutely no relationship to the underlying regulations on the property and don't improve public health and safety and don't improve water quality. Here's what the Creekside property owners look like upstream of me. That sewer grate there, that's the headwaters of the stream that runs through my property. You can see that there's no mitigations for bioswales or anything like that. The water just flows right over a 6-inch curb. These people are no more inconvenienced than having to put up with a little disc on their driveway saying that this runs to the creek. That's their contribution to the protection of public health and safety and preservation of water quality. So there's no dissipation or erosive measures upstream of me, and this is one of the things that staff cites in its report as being necessary under the plan. Let's talk about what's not exempt from Measure 37. I agree with Chris that these sections, he didn't explain why these were not exempt. They're not exempt because all they do is define how the new resource tract is to be maintained. Well, I think he needs to add in this section as well, because it is the section that states which portions of the property are to be forced into this environmental e-zone tract and without compensation. In the staff report, they claim that this is a regulation that limits the disturbance area. Well, that's not true. Let's go back to that for a second. In my report, or actually in staff's report, if you go to page 9, you'll see how this is claimed to be the section that limits the disturbance areas. Well, this is a cut and paste right out of the code. You can see that C and E only state that resource areas are to be placed in environmental tracts. It's section D that discusses the disturbance areas, and I'm not challenging D, and I have actually complied with all of those regulations in my land use decision. And I intend to comply with all of the underlying regulations pertaining to the protection of the environment. I'm only challenging the requirement that I create a separate tract through a forced change of ownership. So what is exempt under the Public Health and Safety Clause that Chris cited earlier? Well, this act shall not apply to land use regulations restricting or prohibiting activities for the protection of public health and safety. Ownership is not an activity under any stretch of any definition. Activities are things that you do with or to your property, where you place a sewer line, where you place a house, how you dig a road, how you maintain it, what plants you put on it. All of those regulations are addressed in other sections of the code. The ownership structure, the name or the way the property is titled, has nothing at all to do with the environmental protections. All of the environmental protections still apply. All of them are being complied with. A change in ownership structure is entirely unnecessary to achieve all of the public health and safety benefits that those regulations provide. So 334.30.160 B, C, and E are not exempt under the Public Health and Safety Escape Clause of Measure 37. We only need to look a little bit further down Fano Creek to get a precedent that's very important in this case, Dolan versus the City of Tigard. An unconstitutional condition exists when government tries to require the exchange of a right, in other words, my right to private property, for a benefit, which would be my right to develop my property, where the property sought has little or no relationship to the benefit. I've already demonstrated through the hazard maps that there's little or no benefit to taking property out of my control to prevent against any hazard that development on my property might cause. And again, I'd like to ask you to ask staff if they have done that individualized determination on my property, which the Supreme Court said was necessary and why they ruled the way they did in Dolan versus Tigard. They have not demonstrated that the required change of ownership is related both in nature and extent to the impact of the proposed development. So the city has failed to do this, and I don't think it would be possible for them even to attempt it, primarily because the existing regulations on my property, if I were to choose to forego a land division and just decide to build Xanadu on my property, under current regulations, governing additions and improvements to my property, the disturbance area would equal at least what is available in a land division type 3 process. In other words, the where I could place buildings and the extent that I could invade the disturbance, the resource areas. No environmental tract would be required. All of this would be possible without jeopardizing public health and safety. I wouldn't have to go through a type 3 or environmental review to obtain this. And all of the development standards would be met. So staff says that there is no restriction in use because I had the opportunity to go through environmental review. Well, I've already pointed out that environmental review is quite a different process and quite a bit more expensive. And it's a false comparison anyway, because Measure 37 doesn't require that I look laterally for a remedy to regulations that came into existence after I purchased my property. There were no environmental tract requirements in 1991, and type 3 processes didn't even exist in 1991. What the true comparison is, what am I permitted to do today, and what was I permitted to do when I purchased my property? That's the only relevant consideration. So also, staff cites only one of the five challenges or claims that I'm making, the fact that my building lot is reduced by 1,375 square feet is only one. The fact that the overall lot size of both lots is reduced and fee simple ownership is taken away from me and I'm required to demolish a barn are all restrictions that that result in a reduction in value. So their claim is baseless, that there was no restrictions and no reduction in value. All of the previously cited claims still apply, and the market analysis took this into account by comparing with equivalent properties. There's really no secret here. It's all contained in the report that you have. Simply put, larger lots are worth more than smaller lots. and the loss in value on my main lot, where my house is, because it dropped 62% in size, is estimated to be $48,270. On the smaller lot, because the building area is reduced and the overall size is reduced, it's a loss in value of $40,000. I don't think we need to go over this so much. The red area is the increase in buildable area, just going back to what was in place on my lot at the time that I purchased it. This is what I applied for, a simple division into two parcels. This is what I ended up with, 52% being forced out of my ownership and into an environmental tract in an entirely different type of ownership, different fee structure, different responsibilities, different rights. So in rebuttal to staff's recommendations, the challenge regs all reduce value. The Type 3 process still requires an environmental tract, which I'm challenging. It applies the wrong test in not comparing it to what was available at the time I purchased the property. The challenge regs are not exempt under Measure 37 because ownership is not an activity, and that's what they're trying to weasel out underneath that. I'm also challenging being stripped of fee simple ownership on my property. They've not provided the individualized determination linking the taking of my property with any public health and safety benefit, so it's a taking also under the Fifth Amendment. So the findings and recommendations of the staff, I'm afraid to say, are baseless and should be rejected. The remedy I'm requesting, and I want to point out to you here, the remedy I'm requesting does not set any kind of irretrievable or irrevocable precedent. It's still possible to force a change of ownership when you can make a link between the necessity of doing that to mitigate the development impacts that are being proposed. That's always something that you and staff can do through an individualized determination. In this case, they failed to meet that test. So I'd like you to consider my remedy separately here. I'm challenging the conditions of approval very simply as follows. B1 is the condition of approval that I create the environmental tract. B2, if the environmental tract goes away, there's no need for a sewer assessment. There's no need for a stormwater easement. There's no need for recording a maintenance agreement. I'm asking to be relieved from the requirement to demolish the barn even before I pursue the recording of the land use decision. And there's no need to execute a maintenance agreement. So given the law, given the facts on the ground, given everything surrounding this case, given the fact that nobody has opposed it, I'm asking you to see the wisdom in allowing me to keep what is rightfully mine. Thank you.
Mr. Carrato, I just want to clarify when you use the phrase forced change of ownership. I want
That's
to be
correct.
Very clear about what you mean by that.
Okay. Right now, I own my property in fee simple ownership. I have 100% control over my property and all of my property. If I were doing this land division across the street where it wouldn't be in an environmental zone and I asked to divide it into two, I'd be given two pieces of property and I would have 100% fee simple ownership in each of those two pieces of property. The environmental zone tract requires that I place the property in the ownership either of a homeowners association, a public entity, or that it be held jointly as an undivided interest between the remaining two lots. So when I sell one of those lots, I end up being forced into a position where I have to share ownership, share responsibilities, share maintenance responsibilities for the environmental zone tract, which is in different ownership. It's taken out of my ownership. When it comes time to list my properties for sale, I can't list them for their original lot size. The lot one drops in size from 22,000 square feet to about 8,500 square feet. Lot two drops in size from about 11,000 square feet to about 7,300 square feet. So I have to list the houses now on 8,300 square foot lot or 7,500 square foot lot, whereas before they were 22 and 11.
And what are you arguing happens to that piece then? Who owns it then?
There are a number of different ownership structures that are allowed in the code. The simplest would be to place it in a joint ownership where the two remaining properties have an undivided interest in it. That's okay. Quite a bit different. Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, so that's why you're using the term
Yes, it's a forced change. It's right. I had fee simple ownership of 100% of the property. I'm left with something less than fee simple ownership on 100% of the property. I'm left with significantly less than fee simple ownership on even the, you know, what would it be? You know, 48% that I'm left with. Okay. Does that answer that question?
I understand what you're saying. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
I had that was a question I had as well. And so you're saying that's a forced change of ownership because the new owners of both tracks allowed to develop in that?
No. That's just it. The tract cannot be sold separately. It must be maintained to the city's standards.
By who?
By the remaining owner, by the two lots that have the undivided interest. But it denies the, for example, me, it denies me the ability to decide who gets to enter my property because the other owner gets to decide that as well. What used to be a large lot and a valuable lot is reduced significantly in value because I lose that kind of control over it and I lose the ability to sell my house based on its lot size of 22,000 square feet.
The ownership is
got a different title, it's got a different set of lot dimensions, it's got a different tax ID number or property ID number. It's removed from my ownership and placed in a different ownership structure that is less than fee simple, which is what I have now. And there's been no attempt by staff to say what public health and safety benefits are being, or what public health and safety is being threatened by my request to divide my property that taking mitigates.
So it sounds like the crux of your argument is wherever we have setbacks on creeks, not just where you're at, don't have any contributing sources of pollution, whether they be runoff or whatever, in a creek. You're basically challenging the whole premise of setbacks.
No, I'm not.
On creeks.
No.
Let me finish.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So you have two small creeks that go into Fano Creek that goes into the Tualatin and then goes into Willamette, which ends up in the Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little confused. You've spent some time arguing how the environmental exemptions under Measure 37 should apply to this, and I'm not clear why
okay.
you think that particular creek of all the creeks in Oregon is different.
No, I'm not challenging the underlying environmental regulations. All of the environmental regulations on the property remain on the property. All of those exist now, even though an environmental track doesn't exist. All of those environmental regulations will still be there, regardless of what the ownership structure of the property is or if I sell it to somebody else. So I have complied with all the environmental regulations. I intend to comply with all of the environmental regulations, the regulations restricting activities such as placing sewer lines or plantings or maintenance or where you can locate the house. All of that, none of those are affected at all by a change of ownership. But staff is forcing me to change ownership for some nebulous benefit to the public health and safety, and they have failed to make the linkage between what that is, what that benefit is to public health and safety that's so great that I am deprived of title on half of my property.
Well, I'm sorry. I hope I'm not belaboring this for anybody else, but I feel like I'm not getting something
okay.
that's been presented.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to help you through that then.
You have one lot that you'd like to be able to subdivide into two lots so you can have a house on each.
Right.
And if that happens under this determination by staff, are you claiming that one of those lots will not be allowed to build a house?
No. No, what I'm saying is that I'm asking for two lots. I'm being forced to create three. The third lot...
I understand that
okay.
argument, but I actually don't buy that, but that's fine. So I'm just trying to figure out what if you're still allowed to build two houses on the parcel and your main point of contention is this environmental setback, it's not restricting your ability to build the houses?
What it's doing is No, I can still build houses, but number one, the buildable area is reduced significantly because the environmental zone tract requirements plus the setback for the new lot line cuts way into the developable area.
That does help. Okay. So if there wasn't the regulation there, you would build the second house in a different place, which is covered by the environmental overlay.
That's correct. And also, go ahead.
I'm just going to ask you to help me through this because I'm just trying to clear this up in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So so your basic argument is if we agree with you and waive the restriction, you would build your house in a place that has previously been determined to have an effect on the water quality in the creek.
No, that's not correct.
Okay.
I would be building in an area that was allowed to me at the time that I purchased my property. And as Chris pointed out in his presentation, if I were to go through Type 3, I would actually have a larger disturbance area available to me than that. So I'm actually asking you for less than what he says is available to me under a Type 3 hearing. So
why wouldn't you go through the Type 3 hearing and avoid all this?
Why would I go through a Type 3 hearing?
Why would you not if staff has suggested that as a way to...
Well, because I've been through a Type 3 hearing. I've already spent $14,000 just to get through the Type 1. It would cost no less, I'm sure, than $40,000 to start from scratch and go through a Type 3 hearing. And then there's no guarantee that you're going to get what you ask for. And there's a significant risk that you're going to end up with a lot of other spurious conditions of approval, like sidewalks and trails and God only knows what else is going to come out of the woodwork. It's just not an equivalent process, and I would still, under Type 3, be required to create these environmental tracts. So I would still have the problem of the overall lot sizes being reduced in size.
That gets me back to my original point. So you're arguing against the premise that certain structures within a certain distance from a creek cause some kind of runoff and pollution in the creek. You're challenging that basic premise.
I don't think so. I don't think I follow your question. Maybe you could.
Accepted that you need to have setbacks on creeks, tributaries,
right,
and others to preserve the water quality and the water temperature.
That's correct.
And all of that. If we don't have trees on creeks, mm-hmm, it heats them up and ultimately ends up heating up the main rivers that they flow into. It sounds to me like you're arguing that if you did not have this restriction and were allowed to build a house where you would like to build it, then you don't think it would have the impact on the water quality stream that apparently these regulations were developed for.
No, if I could direct you to the map that I have here.
Okay.
Here's what's going on. The land division that I have now would place everything in yellow in this environmental zone tract. The buildable area that I would have available to me would be the blue area. All right. What was available to me when I purchased my property would be the additional 10-foot strip there that's shaded in red. 5 feet of that is the setback from the lot line. The other 5 feet is the difference between measuring 25 feet from the center line of the creek and 30 feet from the top of the stream bank. In other words, so I pick up 5 feet there, plus I don't have a setback requirement because there's not a new lot there. And because there's not a new lot, there's not a new lot line. And if there's not a lot line, there's not a 5-foot setback. The setback, maybe that's where the confusion's arising, commissioners. The setback requirement I'm challenging there is the setback of 5 feet inside the property line that is created when this environmental tract is created. If you take away the environmental tract, I'm not talking about building even out as far as what staff has said would be available to me if I were to go through the environmental review. It's going to be a more restrictive building area than what would be available to me under environmental review. But because there wouldn't be a lot line there, I wouldn't have to sacrifice an additional 5 feet in setback from that lot line. The house would still end up being further from the creek than it would be under the environmental review scenario that staff outlined.
Thank you.
Other questions?
So if you have staff back up to ask questions, I would like to hear what their individualized determination was that demonstrates that there are certain public health and safety detriments to the development I propose and that only a forced change of ownership to create this environmental tract can address those.
Thank you.
Instead of the underlying regulations. Thank you very much.
Chris. Did you hear the question?
I did. I did hear the question. And I commend Mr. Corrado because he has a very detailed knowledge of this, and this is very complicated law. But we don't think it's that complicated. We think the analysis, as I explained, is much more simple than Mr. Corrado makes it out to be. First of all, as I stated, we're not basing our recommendation to you on the environmental exceptions as we have in previous claims. We're basing this on a simple finding that there has been no restriction in use of this property. Because, as Mr. Corrado admits, that if he were to go through environmental review, as was recommended, and as he still can today, he would have a greater developable amount of property on his subdivided land, and that's what we're talking about. We're only talking about the subdivision that he's creating here. He would have a greater amount of developable property under environmental review than he would have when he purchased the property in 1991. So he has essentially a net gain in developable property, and so it's hard to make the argument that Measure 37 comes into play when he has not been restricted in his use. Yes, the city does require a resource track there. It's to protect the environmental resources. That's the method that the city has chosen to make sure that that protection is in perpetuity, regardless of whether the ownership to adjacent lots comes and goes, changes. But what we want, what we look at, and again, here's where we do agree with Mr. Corrado, is the relevant question for you is what could he do when he purchased the property under a like apples-to-apples subdivision situation? What could he do in 1991 versus what could he do today in terms of the developable amount of property that he has? We think he has a greater amount now. He is not restricted. His property has not been restricted. He is not eligible for a claim. He makes a lot of other detailed arguments, which I'm not going to get into, because we don't think it, for this Measure 37 claim, that those are very relevant.
So he, in his response to that point, is that that's an uncertain process. He could end up at the other end after having spent a lot of money and maybe not prevail or have other restrictions. So
that is an uncertain process. He has to go through a staff review. But our staff, in looking at this, see no reason why there would not be a positive recommendation here. And he has to go through a public hearing. And as I said, he's done a terrific job of talking to his neighbors. And all of his neighbors are in favor of what he wants to do here. So we don't see any opposition. So all of the uncertainty, and yes, there is uncertainty, we think all the uncertainty that we can see is gone away.
And what about the money that he said he'd have to spend, the $40,000? What would that be for?
Well, I can't speak to what he spent money on previously. Part of it, I'm sure, was on consultants.
I'm talking about, he said it would cost him $40,000 to go through this process. What does that
mean? I can't speak to that. Does anybody else know what environmental review process would cost?
I'm Kimberly Parsons, Senior Planner with Land Division and Environmental Review Team. I think the fee for a Type 3 environmental review with a concurrent land division is closer to $6,000 or $7,000 for the application fee.
Are there any other costs besides that that he would need?
Consulting costs that he would need to provide for certain maps. And.
But if staff's already looked at it and thinks it qualifies, why would he have to go hire people? Is there a reason?
I wouldn't see a large reason. There are many homeowners that do write up their own land use applications, so he has the possibility to do that.
Any other information you wish to share in terms of Mr. Corrado's response?
I really have nothing more to add, because even though he makes a lot of arguments, I believe it comes down to a very simple and clear determination here.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Corrado, would you like to respond to that? This will be the last opportunity.
Yes, I would like to respond to that. Thank you.
on a couple of things. They state that the relevant issue is what is available to me under a Type 3 review versus what I have now. Measure 37 states that the relevant comparison is what is the regulations being enforced on me now. In other words, I have a land use decision. They are enforcing requirements on me now. Compare those to what was available to me when I purchased the property. The comparison to what might be available to me under a more burdensome and costly process is irrelevant. The comparison is what is the land use regulation being enforced on me now compared to what was available to me when I bought the property. That's the crux of the matter. That's stated in the regulations. Whether or not Type 3 might result in a more beneficial building area is irrelevant. The largest part of the financial loss cited in my claim is the reduction in the lot size of lot number one where my house sits. And that has no relation whatsoever to the buildable area in parcel two. And I would still have that reduction in lot size under a Type 3 hearing because I would still be forced to create an environmental tract. That lot would still drop in size by 62% and drop in value by over $48,000. That's the relevant criteria. About the fees. The fee for a Type 1 hearing is, I think, under $2,000, but I've spent over $13,000 just getting it through. When you pay the fee, all you've done is bought the right to pay the consultants a ton of money to comply with these extremely burdensome and complicated regulations. And there are reports that have to be drawn up, maps that have to be done, surveys that have to be done, and that are way beyond what's required in Type 1 review that are very, very expensive. As I mentioned, I finished a Type 3 review process on my parents' property, which was adjacent to mine, just the year before I started this. And I'll tell you the truth, I was gun-shy. I didn't want to ever go through that again. I'm still suffering from the brain damage from that process. So suggesting that I can get through a Type 3 process for only $6,000 is just way, way, way understates the true costs. And you have to remember this is on top of $13,000 plus that I've already spent, and that doesn't include the costs of preparing for this presentation before you here today and my Measure 37 claim. So the point that Chris was making that it was necessary to put the environmental tract in a different ownership structure was to protect those regulations in perpetuity. Well, that is a specious argument. The regulations that are in place that protect the environment are the underlying environmental regulations, and those follow the property regardless of who owns it. It's not necessary to preserve those regulations. It's not necessary to force the creation of an environmental tract to preserve those regulations. Those regulations exist now, under my house right now. If I choose not to do a land use decision and just sell my property, those land use regulations will continue in perpetuity as well. So that, again, is a specious argument. What it comes back to is I have fee simple ownership and the ability to claim that I own a house that's on a 22,000 square foot lot and advertise it as such and expect a price that would bring. After this goes through, I now have a house that sits on an 8,500 square foot lot that has an environmental tract attached to it that is really not an asset. It's a liability because I'm still forced to pay liability insurance. I'm still forced to maintain it to the city standards. I lose control over who can come onto my property, and it is an arrangement that's less than fee simple ownership, and it has a financial impact, and it's also true of parcel number two. The buildable area is probably only 30% of the overall financial impact of the claim. So again, the relevant comparison is, what are the regulations that are being enforced on me now under the land decision use, the land decision that I have in hand? What are the restrictions being placed on me now under that land use decision that were not enforced in 1991 when I purchased the property. What might be available to me in some speculative arrangement in a different process under regulations that came into effect after I purchased my property is irrelevant. So again, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You're saying that because you choose not to go through a Type 3, that we should waive a requirement for you to do that in order for you to save the money so that you don't have to?
No, Mayor, I guess what I'm saying is that I would be forced to file a Measure 37 claim even if I got a Type 3 approval that is as favorable as they suggest might be available. The reason is that I would still be required to set aside 52% of my property into an environmental tract where I no longer own it fee simple, where it reduces the size of the lots that I own, and it negatively impacts the value. I would still have to file a Measure 37 claim under that condition if I wanted to, because a Type 3 review is still going to require the dedication of that environmental tract through a forced change of ownership. That's the thrust of my claim. So going through Type 3 is not going to resolve the issue that I'm bringing up here.
Well, the issue you're bringing up, the issue that Chris raised, is that by going through a Type 3, that you would be actually eligible for more land for development as opposed to what you would have been in 1982?
That's possible. What I'm also saying is that additional few feet of building space is irrelevant to me compared to the cost of what it would get would be to get a Type 3 hearing through the process and the concomitant brain damage as well.
Well, your brain doesn't seem to be suffering, Mr. Curro. You've been very articulate.
And creative, I would add.
I don't think I'm being creative at all. I think I'm giving you a very, very straightforward interpretation of Measure 37 and your obligations under Measure 37.
I understand your argument, but yeah. I think what I'm just getting my arms around is we have to accept the premise that if somebody buys a brand new house on this second lot, that if you tell them this lush green area that abuts the backyard of your house, which has a creek, can never be built on. You're wanting us to agree that that devalues the property?
No. They would know that when they purchased the property. And if the environmental zone tract didn't exist, they still wouldn't be able to build back there.
I understand
that. I'm not suggesting.
The crux of your argument is even if you go through the Type 3 and you win, you're arguing that the restrictions that are in place because of the environmental zone decreases the value of the property because you're arguing it isn't in your control to do with what you want.
Well, what I'm arguing is that take a look at the difference in size here.
No, I don't need to do that.
I list my house. What the market analysis was based on was very simply houses on smaller lots sell for less than houses on larger lots.
Where you have fences, but
No, that doesn't matter. Let me point out the fallacy there. Yes, people do benefit from the creation of these environmental tracts, but not me. My neighbors benefit from that.
Whoever buys the house, I would think, would find it very attractive having a house in an urban area that had a protected stream behind it. I mean, I live in such a place.
Okay.
I've been to his house, and he does.
You're wanting me to accept that as an argument is, I just know that's not true.
Okay, but Commissioner, let me put it this way: how large is your lot?
It's irrelevant.
No, it's not.
You know why
it's,
I can't
it's
tell
exactly.
you how large my lot is? I don't know. Oh. It's smaller than what it is if you included the creek back. I know that, but to me, it's part of the ambiance and
can
why
ask
we
a
like
question,
living.
Randy, right on this. When you did your market analysis, did you have any specific examples of comparing, I'll just use an arbitrary number, 22,000 square foot fee simple lots to 15,000 fee simple lots adjacent to 7,000 square foot protected tracts? I mean, because that's really the apples to apples. It's not a 22,000 to a 15, mm-hmm. because functionally the buyer is going to have the same benefit of that property. So, I mean, did you do that analysis? Because that to me would be what would prove or disprove mm-hmm. your argument, not 15 to 22.
Well, for starters, these regulations incidentally, were slipped through the back door just within the last couple of years. I never heard of any public discussion of the requirement to create these lots, and I've been following this. Literally, this process started, and I have copies of the testimony in 1991 before the Planning Commission when the Fano Creek and Tributaries Conservation Plan first started, months, just months after buying my property, and it's been a 15-year battle. And I've stayed right on top of this. I was never notified that there was any discussion that that there would be an ordinance passed that would force the creation of an environmental zone tract and take away a portion of my property. Okay, but that's tangential to your question, which and the reason it's relevant is that this is fairly new, and so there aren't very many precedents to look for, and you can only compare comparable sales where sales have taken place. But the market analysis that we did identified 19 properties in the multiple listing service area that I'm in that were adjusted for their size and their age so that they were comparable. And then it divided those 19 properties into two subgroups, houses on lots less than 10,000 square feet and houses on lots more than 10,000 square feet. And then you run the numbers and you figure out how much did they pay per square foot of their house. And when you run through that, you can find a ratio of what premium they're willing to pay for that extra property beyond the 10,000 square feet, even though they can't develop it. It's just a big yard. They're not buying development rights. They're just buying the fact that they like a big yard. Well, I no longer have a big yard. I have a lot that went from 22,000 square feet in size down to 80-something. That's a big difference.
But you have joint ownership with one other neighbor or no
joint
other neighbor.
Ownership is not the same as fee simple ownership.
You're interrupting me probably.
I'm sorry, Commissioner.
It's your tactic. It's probably you have joint ownership of the large yard with the person next to you, and it's your choice to decide it's going to be two lots. I mean, you could sell the 22,000 square feet as it is without
I can't do any kind of addition with any kind of a division.
I said the 22,000 square feet. It's a 22,000 right? square foot lot. You could sell it as you bought it. If you divide it, then you run into these regulations. If you're not going to divide, it's irrelevant what's going to happen to these tracts. They're not going to be created. So if you still can divide it and build another house, but I'm just questioning the assumption that you're not arguing there'd be any more or less space next to the two homes. You're saying that because they're jointly on the space, the house is worth significantly less than if one house owned it.
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that when it comes time to sit down with a real estate agent and list the property, do you list the property as being 22,000 square feet in size? Okay, maybe here's where the confusion comes in. The entire lot size that I have now is over 33,000 square feet. Okay,
that's right. I had that wrong.
Okay. So when I split the 33,000 in two, I end up with one that's 22 and one that's about 11. All right? But when the environmental tract gets created, I end up with, I've got the exact numbers in the presentation here somewhere. I can find them if you want. Here we go. One lot drops in size by 62% from 22,000 square feet down to about 85. I don't remember the exact number. The other drops from about 11,000 square feet down to about 7,300 square feet. So when it comes down to listing the house for sale, it would be more valuable to be able to list it as being on a piece of property that is 22,000 square feet in size than on a piece of property that's 8,500 square feet in size.
So your analysis ascribes no value to the what would be 18,000 square feet of joint environmentally protected land that the two homes own together, depending how you set it up. Basically say there's no value to that, and that we should pay for the difference between a 22,008. And that's mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you've used a lot of terms like baseless. That doesn't hold up. I mean, the idea that there's no value to that environmental track, and you're due. I mean, I think it kind of your argument starts to slip quite a bit with me in that you're claiming that the citizens owe you for the entire value of an environmental track that would continue to be privately owned and enjoyed and would not be developed. I mean, just the idea that the full value is owed because you can't sell it fee simple just doesn't hold up, because then you're getting paid. There is value to that land.
Okay. I've checked with the Multnomah County Recorder, and actually they will carry the environmental zone tract at zero real market value. Okay.